Our civic duty is not just to go caucus on February 1st. Actually, that's a small part of our civic duty. Our civic duty starts on January 1, ends on December 31st, and then it starts again on January 1. We have to stay engaged all the time if we want to make our communities more just, more fair, more small-D democratic.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Later in the show, we visit with Keith Abraham of Story County Emergency Services Management about new efforts to upgrade emergency medical services for all corners of the county. We also hear from the founder of Friends of Emily McCarthy Park in Munn Woods about that group's attempts to preserve the character of these natural refuges in our midst. For our main story today, however, we at Heart of Iowa Radio will be following the lead of the nation at large, which, of course, is following the state of Iowa in this month leading up to the caucuses. Yes, those of you who have the grumpy attitude that holidays are just things to get through can get your grump right back on. It's caucus season, and this may be even more exhausting than the 5+ weeks between Thanksgiving and New Year's. Then again, if you're a party person, well, anyway, it will all end February 1st, when we Iowans brave frost or unseasonable flood to do that thing so few people elsewhere understand. We at KHOI Community Radio plan not only to cover the Iowa caucuses, but also to help our national affiliate, Pacifica Radio Network, and the stations who belong to it, get a handle on Iowa's role in the presidential primary process. We begin our national broadcasting this Saturday with live coverage of a Des Moines candidate forum that two Democratic candidates, Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders, have pledged to attend. In a moment, we will hear my interview with David Redlosk, a political scientist, now a fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake, who is writing his second book on the Iowa caucuses. But first, let's hear from Hugh Espy, director of the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement and chief organizer of the upcoming candidate forum this Saturday at First Christian Church in Des Moines. Hugh Espy, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement.
In the morning, we're going to be doing an issue summit that's going to be digging in on a variety of economic, environmental, and racial justice and money and politics issues. And we have some national movement leaders there that are going to be working with grassroots leaders to do those workshops. There'll be a couple plenary sessions where everybody's together. But most of the morning, we're going to be doing these issue workshops, about 60 minutes long. And we're going to cover 10 different topics, again, in an environmental, economic, racial justice, and a money and politics frame. And that'll run till about 12:30 or so. We'll have lunch. Then that adjourns, and then at 1:30, we do the candidate forum, and we've got Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley coming. Again, we're going to be tackling the same sorts of issues that we were talking about in the morning, a broad array, a variety of economic, environmental, racial justice, and money and politics issues. And it's not so much about the candidates doing a stump speech. Each candidate is going to be there one at a time on stage by himself with a team of grassroots leaders from Iowa and Midwestern states. Also, Reka Basu from the Register, the Des Moines Register, a reporter, a writer from The Nation magazine, and then Dorian Warren from the Roosevelt Institute, who's going to moderate. And so it's not so much us listening to the candidates give stump speeches. It's more about them listening to our stories, responding to our questions about specific issues. And we're going to cover at least six issues, six topics with each candidate. So we're going to over a 50-minute period. So it's, you know, we're asking the candidates to answer questions and kind of like get to the point. And we'll do the same thing with our stories and issues. So it's a long day. It's going to be a good day. It's about putting people and planet first. It's about making sure that government works for people. It's about talking about an economy that works for everyone, not just the wealthy few. We're expecting 400 to 500 folks from across the state to be there. There'll be people from neighboring states there as well, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Missouri. But it's all about talking to the candidates, but recognizing that small D democracy and justice and fairness starts with people and it ends with people. It's up to us to make stuff happen. And that's what we're going to be doing on January 9th.
So you said the candidates won't be there together on stage together, so it won't be a traditional debate format.
That's correct. It's a forum. So we'll have at 2 o'clock we'll have Martin O'Malley, and he'll be on stage with our grassroots leaders and Reka Basu and Dorian Warren for about 50 minutes. Again, responding to stories and questions that we're talking about that impact our day-to-day lives. Then at 3 o'clock, Bernie Sanders will be there. Same sort of format. Each candidate gets an opening statement and a closing statement, but in between, we're really digging in on issues and questions and topics that matter to us.
Okay. This sounds like a lot of work to organize, and here you are on Sunday of a holiday weekend in the office alone. Why do you think such a thing is necessary?
Well, I mean, if we're going to make Iowa better for lots more people, if we're going to make sure our communities are more just, more fair, more small-D democratic, we got to work at it. And we cannot leave it up to candidates to do our bidding. We have to do our own bidding, and we have to raise issues with candidates, find out where they stand, and then once they're elected, we got to hold them accountable. So we have to stay engaged and inform citizenry. Is a powerful tool. We have to stay engaged 24/7, 365. Our civic duty is not just to go caucus on February 1st. Actually, that's a small part of our civic duty. Our civic duty starts on January 1, ends on December 31st, and then it starts again on January 1. We have to stay engaged all the time if we want to make our communities more just, more fair, more small-D democratic.
Best of luck on this event. Anything else you'd like to add about it?
If people want to sign up and register for the event, it's free of charge, but we're going to do box lunches there, so we're trying to keep track of how many folks are going to be there. So we're asking people to register ahead of time. You can go to cciaction.org to register and, show up. And it's going to be a good day, and it's up to us. Be there, get engaged, and give legs to democracy.
Okay, and this is at the First Christian Church at 2500 University Avenue in Des Moines.
That's correct. People can also call the CCI headquarters if they want to register, and that number here in Des Moines is 515-282-0484.
515-282-0484.
That's it.
Okay, and we'll put both of those things on our website as well.
Sure. Oh, awesome.
That was Hugh Espy, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. KHOI and the Local Talk team is proud to be partnering with that organization to bring you a broadcast of the event this Saturday, with a roundup of issues and strategies starting at 1 p.m., Martin O'Malley live at 2 p.m., and Bernie Sanders live at 3 p.m. Explore the links on our page, show up, or tune in to hear what national leaders are saying about the issues you care about. We're all about citizen engagement here at KHOI. So is our next guest, currently a fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. I caught David Redlosk this Sunday just before he headed out to a Mike Huckabee candidate event at the Machine Shed. I'm here with David Redlosk. He is a political scientist at Rutgers University, the director of the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling. He formerly was at the University of Iowa as a political scientist and currently is spending 1 year of fellowship at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy. His specialty are the Iowa caucuses. I guess it's used in the plural. Is that correct?
Yes, I'd use it in the plural. There are multiple caucuses. We talk either way about it, but there are actually this year 1,681 precinct caucuses for each party. So it's perfectly right to say the Iowa caucuses.
Okay. David, you've written a book called Why Iowa? That was published in 2011 with two other colleagues, focusing on the Iowa caucuses and their role in the election. What is the answer to that question? Why Iowa?
Well, my colleagues, Carolyn Tolbert, Todd Donovan, and I were absolutely fascinated by the sequential nature of our nomination process. And that is, some states go early, some states go late. And the question about that sequence led us to the question about Iowa. Why is Iowa first, and what is the role that Iowa plays? Well, the first part's kind of simple. Why Iowa is first is more or less an accident of history. It kind of just happened in 1972. Why Iowa from the nomination process, however, is a much more complex question, and it has to do a lot with the way Iowans pay careful attention to candidates, the way candidates come into Iowa, and the way the media covers both of them.
Yeah, we are known for what's called retail politics. Can you explain that term?
Yeah, retail politics basically means talking to people, as opposed to running lots of television ads or flying in, holding big events and disappearing again. Retail politics is about, as we say, being on the ground, both for the candidate from event to event, talking to individuals, but also for the candidate's campaign, having a lot of field offices, having people who are working the voters on an ongoing basis in the run-up to the election, or in our case, the run-up to the caucuses.
Okay, and your book makes the argument that this is a good way for voters to decide upon a candidate, that the caucus really adds a lot to the national election process.
We think that the caucus does add a lot to the process, and it adds a lot to the process primarily because it happens in a small state. We are in a state, Iowa, where about 250,000 people or so, maybe 300,000 will show up to caucus on both sides total. The reality is candidates can nearly shake the hand of everybody who will go caucus for them if they spend enough time here. And we think that gets candidates out of the political bubble that they're often in, whether they are experienced politicians and always have people around them telling them yes, or whether they're non-politicians, but they're still not average people. By coming to Iowa, by going around the state, by talking to individual voters, these candidates get a real feel for what's going on in Iowa, but in the country as a whole, something they do not get when they run pure media campaigns in large states.
They also get some talk back.
They absolutely do. One of the most important things in this is how Iowans ask questions. And as I've been going around this year in 2016, it's reinforcing what we learned from 2012 and 2008 in particular, and that is Iowans ask a lot of questions. A lot of Iowans ask questions, and they ask questions of national importance, not just parochial things that might only matter to Iowans. And so candidates have to absolutely be on their game. Candidates have to be able to answer these questions. You know, these Iowa voters aren't particularly happy if the candidate tries to slough it off or turn it to something else or ignore the questioner. It's really, really important for candidates in Iowa to be accessible, to have Q&A, and to actually answer the questions.
We'll talk more about that in a bit. Your book makes an interesting argument saying that some people say Iowans are doing others a favor by all this hard work of asking questions.
Well, because we have this sequential system, and because Iowa comes first, firstly, Iowa is inundated, right? I mean, hundreds and hundreds of visits by candidates. It starts years in advance of the presidential election. But more importantly, from our standpoint, we see campaigns and elections as about information and the flow of information to voters across the country as the campaign progresses. What Iowans are doing essentially, and New Hampshireites as well, because that comes right after Iowa, is spending a lot more time with the candidates, vetting the candidates, and sending signals to voters in later states about the candidates who look presidential and those who don't. Importantly, what we find in our research is that Iowa voters tend to do what we say, vote sincerely. And what we mean by sincere voting is they vote based on who they really think is the best candidate, not on things like who's the most likely to win. That would be strategic voting. And the fact is, from the standpoint of information flows to voters over time, over the course of the nomination, sincere voting in Iowa sends really important signals to voters in later states.
That's very interesting that we're known for being sincere, I guess.
It looks that way, at least in the case of the presidential nominations.
And there are some alternatives to the sequential system.
So the sequential system we have just developed over time, and it's because states have the right essentially to set when they'll hold their nominating event. The national parties can't control it. There is nothing in federal law. In fact, there's nothing in the Constitution about presidential nominations. So a lot of people look at this and say it's a crazy system. It goes on for a long time. Candidates have to go from one state to another. Later states don't get as many choices as earlier states because candidates drop out and so on. One potential solution to that, if you think that's a problem, is the national primary. And the national primary essentially would look just like a general election. Everyone in the country would vote on the same day, would have the same set of candidates on the ballot, and the winner of the national primary would presumably become the nominee for the party. Now, it's a lot more complex than that in terms of the rules and how it would actually work. But the one thing I think we can say with some certainty is a national primary would have different results than the sequential system.
And for 2008, for example, we would not have Barack Obama elected president.
I don't think so. In fact, we opened the book Why Iowa with a vignette of the new president taking the oath of office. And we say, as she raises her hand, we suggest that in 2008, Hillary Clinton might well have won in a national primary environment, as might have Rudy Giuliani on the Republican side. Why do we say that? Because in 2007, they were far and away the polling leaders nationally for their respective parties. Clinton led all comers. Giuliani was far ahead. And had it gone into a national primary, presumably they would have had the inside track both in fundraising and in support from voters.
Okay. So has anything changed between now and then? You said Iowans ask a lot of questions. I've heard other people say that the candidates are not quite as available as they have been in the past.
No, the 2016 cycle is definitely been different, and it's been different in a couple of ways. One is for the Republicans and even for the Democrats, the rise of the outsider. Bernie Sanders, while he's a senator, he's not a Washington outsider, but he's an outsider for the Democratic Party. And of course, on the Republican side, there are a number of outsiders led by Donald Trump. What's particularly interesting about both Trump and Sanders, especially, is that they are holding very large-scale events at which they rarely, if ever, take direct questions from voters. They're not having the kind of intimate events that candidates in Iowa typically have. Whether that's going to pay off in 2016, we won't know until February 1st, but it's certainly not the typical way to run an Iowa caucus campaign. There are different kinds of events. Meet and greets are generally a little bit different from a town hall. The candidates come in, there's a crowd around, they shake a few hands, they might say a few general words, and they kind of work the crowd itself. Events that are billed as town halls, voters come in expecting to be able to do Q&A, expecting the bulk of the event to be questions and answers. However, that's not always the case. Marco Rubio has really struck me. I've been to several events that have been billed town halls. He comes in, he gives a standard stump speech that's rarely adjusted for the particular crowd, and maybe takes a question or two, but more often than not, does not. And so, you know, calling that a town hall sets an expectation among voters that, at least to date, he's often not meeting.
And also, since 2008, we've had the insurgence of a political activist group on the Republican side, the Tea Party, of course. How does the Tea Party affect the way the caucus campaigning is going?
When we talk about the Iowa caucuses, we tend to think in the Republican Party about two major groups, evangelical Christians and sort of more mainstream, business-oriented, what have you, Republicans. For Republicans in Iowa, evangelical Christians are likely to make up about 60% of the caucus goers. And so they tend to be the big focus here. So it's not that Tea Partiers don't exist, but as we're talking about the campaign this year, the appeal is a little bit different because there's a strong social element and even a religious element in that appeal that often with the Tea Party per se, it's not as directly along those lines.
But Huckabee in 2008 was a very strong evangelical candidate. He won the Iowa caucus. That did not influence the national vote.
Actually, Huckabee winning the Iowa caucus in 2008 did influence the national vote based on our research. The fact that he won in 2008, and more importantly, because Iowa is not so much about winning as it is about beating expectations. So Mike Huckabee not just won in 2008, but stunned expectations by winning. And he did go a lot further into the process than we expected him to because of that, right? Had he not done that, he'd have probably been out of the race almost immediately after Iowa. The same thing in 2012 with Rick Santorum. While the Republican Party announced that Romney had been the winner, it was actually Rick Santorum who won by a handful of votes. So it was essentially a tie. And our data show very clearly that media attention shifted to Santorum quite dramatically after he won. And again, he continued on in the process longer than we might have expected otherwise. Our political science, you know, complex mathematical models show that, in fact, Santorum's support in Iowa, like Huckabee's in 2008, does correlate with how many votes he got in primaries after Iowa in a positive direction. That is, they did well here. They did better than expected elsewhere.
Okay. And that's kind of the message of this book, is that as the sequential process goes on, candidates get paired out and people become more strategic in their vote, who's gonna have the power to win?
Right, because it's sequential, not every candidate is going to be able to continue all the way through. And so in a sequential system, voters in the early states send information to voters in the later states. But the thing I really want to emphasize about Iowa is this expectations game, right? So historically, Iowa is not so much about win Iowa, win the nomination, as it is about do badly in Iowa and you're done. So Iowa and New Hampshire both tend to winnow the field. They tend to cut out candidates who don't at least beat expectations. You don't have to win, but you do have to do better than expected if you want to continue.
I noticed that you have a book on your desk with your name on it called The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. Is that true also for the caucus and primary level of politics? Is there a good case for negative campaigning?
So I always like titles that are unexpected, and The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning is certainly unexpected. This is also an informational argument. The lack of negativity would mean voters are not well informed. That is, no candidate's going to ever say something bad about herself. So somebody has to, in a sense, if we want voters to be fully informed, because there's no perfect candidate out there. So our argument in this book is basically that negativity provides important information into the campaign environment. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have its blowback. It doesn't mean it doesn't have problems, right? Voters are somewhat negative about negativity. Not that they dislike getting information. They actually like getting information in our studies in this book. But certain kinds of negativity gets them angry. And a great example, it's just happened, is actually as Donald Trump is putting down various opponents, you know, he's attacking Hillary Clinton. And he's attacking Hillary Clinton partly for Bill Clinton. One of the really interesting things in our studies is that attacks on issues, attacks on experience, attacks essentially on things that are relevant are acceptable to voters. But on things that they don't think are relevant, and in particular, we looked at attacks on family and we looked at attacks on religion. And those create a real blowback among voters. So now Trump seems to be a special case generally, but my point here is that there are topics you can go negative on and topics you can't. And when we talk about Iowa, however, because the campaigning is so personal most of the time, because the number of voters is so small, because candidates get to know voters, there's some sense that there's a line that is dangerous to cross. And we look at 2004. As a perfect example, Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt started tearing each other apart in the last month of the campaign. And maybe partly as a result, and I say maybe, John Kerry and John Edwards came in 1-2. So negative campaigning is always a challenge, but our basic argument about it is that if we banned it, voters would be worse off.
So do you have a working title for your next book?
I don't yet. Often the title doesn't come to mind until a lot of the book is written and you see where it's going.
But in general, is there a direction that you're taking this research that you're willing to share?
So this time around, the Why Iowa book is driven a lot by survey research, by data. It's a very political science-y book. What I'm working on this time around is much more what political scientists, based on a guy, Richard Fenno, many years ago called soaking and poking. And soaking and poking is going to events. It's talking to people. I've interviewed a number of political elites on both parties about the caucus process, about the caucus history. I've gone to dozens of events, and we'll do dozens more over the next month, with the idea of trying to get a feel for it, trying to get an understanding on the ground in a way that voters do. So the direction I'm going right now is to try to understand how candidates are connecting with voters. Much of what I've been doing for the last several months has been collecting stuff. And so I haven't really started digging through it all. But the one rhetorical thing that struck me almost from day one, I watched all 20 Des Moines Register soapbox speeches at the Iowa State Fair in August, is the way the rhetoric on both sides is sounding really similar. And that's odd, right? You can take some of the things Republicans are saying about the little guy, the middle class, the American worker is getting screwed by the big guy. Republicans are saying it. Democrats are saying it. They have very different definitions of who the big guy is, and they have different definitions of how to presumably solve the problem. But you can take some of the rhetoric from the Republicans, put it in a Democrat's mouth, and it will not surprise you at all. I feel like, in some sense, this is one of the few really clear things that came out of the Occupy movement, the idea of the 1%. Again, Republicans don't talk the 99 and 1, but they do talk about how corporations and government, but also corporations, are hurting the American worker. And I think that's absolutely fascinating.
I just have to ask you, I knew you in Iowa City as a Democratic Party person, so you are now researching both sides. And how is that? How do you do that? How do you maintain your objectivity as a researcher?
Well, you know, essentially that's my job, right? I'm supposed to maintain academic objectivity. And I'm tweeting most of these events, and I'm trying to tweet them fairly down the middle, my observations, my reactions, what the candidates say, without putting value judgments on it. I guess that's kind of the key for doing objective research. Now, having said that, there's no such thing as pure objectivity. We all stand somewhere. And so it is a challenge to kind of just listen to people with whom I may disagree strongly and just try to understand what they're saying, why they're saying it, and how they're trying to connect, right? I think this is a fascinating part of my role now. I left the University of Iowa in 2009. I went to run the polling center at Rutgers, where I agreed to not do partisan politics, to stay neutral publicly, and I do that. But before that, part of my research is informed by the fact that I was very involved in the Iowa caucuses as a Democrat. I ran my precinct caucus. I ran the Johnson County caucuses in 2004. And I was a John Edwards, sad to say, delegate to the Democratic National Convention, being elected through the caucus and convention process in 2008. So all of that is useful because it gives me background and understanding. But I try to do my best to kind of put that aside as I look at the big picture.
So you tweet about the events you're going to. Can you share your Twitter handle?
Yeah, it's just my name. My name is my brand, right? So it's at David Redlosk. Very straightforward and simple.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for talking with us about the caucuses and the process.
Appreciate talking with you. It's been fun.
That was David Redlosk, political scientist, currently a fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, talking about Iowa caucus goers and their tendency to be sincere in their political preferences. That institute, by the way, is the same one that in early 2014 failed to get a foothold at Iowa State University when negotiations between Senator Tom Harkin and the university broke down over what Harkin called issues of academic freedom. You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. When we return, Keith Morgan joins us to talk about efforts to evaluate and upgrade emergency medical services to all residents of Story County.
Now you can feel my heart.
Ibei, a duo of twin sisters originally from Havana, Cuba, whose self-titled album, Ibei, appeared on at least one top albums of 2015 list last week. In the studio, we have one of the Local Talk team's best discoveries of 2015, our regular guest, Keith Morgan, who comes here with hints and updates about how we and Story County can be survivors. Keith is the county's emergency management coordinator. Welcome, Keith. Happy New Year.
Good morning. Happy New Year to you.
So you've come to tell us about efforts to evaluate Story County's emergency medical response system. That's basically what happens when a person calls 911, right?
Right. And it's a little bit more complex than a lot of people really understand.
Okay. So it's a phone call to 911 sort of sets off a chain reaction involving a lot of players. So let's just imagine it's the weekend, so things are a little different, and we've got a call coming from, say, McCallsburg. And what happens? Want to talk us, where does the call go to, you know, from the citizen in McCallsburg, and what happens after that?
That's a good example, because when you start looking at a call, a lot of people don't understand all of the different players that come in our emergency medical response system. That caller in McCallsburg, their phone call, if they're calling from their landline, would go to Story County Sheriff's Office dispatch. And right away, we begin to look at the medical situation and do some evaluation. These dispatchers are trained to start looking through and taking in those symptoms and deciding who to dispatch out. In the meantime, they may already start to provide some information to the caller to be able to assist that person that's having a medical difficulty. The next step that they're going to do is to call out what we call the first responders, or the EMS, the Emergency Medical Services, which in McCallsburg would be a volunteer organization. They work sometimes within a fire department, or they are a separate agency with a fire department. And they will go ahead and call out these first responders, EMS folks, that will be hopefully the first on scene and will begin to do those first aid kind of activities, the initial stuff, the airway, the bleeding, and the circulation part of it. And meanwhile, they'll be dispatching an ambulance. Now, we have different ambulance services across Story County. We have one that comes out of Story County Medical Hospital over in Nevada. We have ones that come out of the Mary Greeley Medical Center. We even have ambulances services up in Story City and also down in Huxley. So typically they have different areas, and if I remember right, McCallsburg would be serviced by Story County Medical. So the first responders living in that community are going to get on site right away and begin that initial treatment. Meanwhile, the ambulance is dispatched out there. When the ambulance gets on scene, then they're going to go ahead and take the patient from the emergency medical services and try and get them back to the hospital. Sometimes, though, we may have to share ambulances across the different districts, because we typically have 5 or so ambulances available across all of Story County at any one time. So the Story County dispatch, if there isn't an ambulance available from Story County Medical, may have to talk to the Ames dispatch over to Mary Greeley to dispatch one of their ambulances on up there. So you can see that there's a lot of different partners all working together to try and get this medical system working and to service the citizens.
Okay, so that dispatch person who is located in the sheriff's office?
For Story County sheriffs, they're located over in Nevada. We also have a dispatch agency that services just Ames, and they're located with the police department. And we also have yet another dispatch agency at Iowa State University, which is concentrating on the university itself.
Oh, my goodness. That is complicated. And I want to ask about insurance. Do you have to ask the patient, you know, what kind of insurance you have or anything like that?
No, they dispatch the medical services without any question. Insurance is always an afterthought down the road. If you need medical, it's going to be sent to you, and they'll work that out down the road.
Okay. And we have two hospitals in the area.
Correct.
And both of them, the Story County Medical building there south of 30, has an emergency room.
Yes, they have an emergency room. Mary Greeley has a more emergency medical services. Again, with the information that those first responders give, they can already start to determine whether it is the best to take them to Story County Medical, to Mary Greeley, or they may at that time say this person needs to go on down to Des Moines, and then we bring in yet another layer where they'll dispatch possibly a helicopter, one of the two helicopters in the Des Moines area, to come on up, pick up the patient, and take them directly on down to one of the Des Moines trauma centers that have more capabilities.
Wow. So the dispatcher and also the emergency responders have a lot of decision-making responsibilities. And also, I imagine, quite a bit of communication takes place all along this chain.
That's the hope, that the information is flowing back and forth and that decisions are made in a timely manner to make sure that the patient goes to the area where they're going to get the best medical or the most appropriate medical. Because, again, we wouldn't want to call out a helicopter from Des Moines if it's a minor injury. So there's that kind of evaluation and best utilization of our resources all throughout the system.
So you are working together with all these partners who come together or potentially come together in any one call to evaluate how this system can be improved in Story County?
Exactly. Although the commission that I work for, the Emergency Management Commission, is not directly tasked with looking at the overall medical system, we are concerned about it when we get to that far extreme where we would have a disaster or something like that, to make sure that we have the right kind of capabilities. The other thing is my commission is made up of the mayors of all of the communities around here. They represent both the citizens, and they also represent the taxes, the people that are going to have to levy these taxes, because we also have the board of supervisors on board. So we were discussing where we're at right now and where could we be going. You have to be ahead of the game when it comes to making adjustments to the system. So we had a discussion at one of our meetings, and they have tasked me to put together a committee to look at where are we at now. And we're going into this with a blank sheet of paper to say, where are we at? How much capability do we have? Is there any way we can get more efficiencies out of these capabilities? Plus looking out 5 years from now so that we can see where do we need to be so that we can, in the most cost-effective manner, make adjustments to the system or plan out how we might need to expand the system in the future.
And so what sorts of things are you looking at in order to make those projections?
One of the first things is, where does that call come in from? Who's making the call? Who's utilizing the system? Also, looking at our demographics, is the median age getting older or younger? Then we are making informed decisions when it comes along to what we need. Also, where should that capability be? Is there a better way that we can position it to be able to respond to needs? Do we need more of these volunteers out in the communities, those first responders? Are we going to be able to get more volunteers in the future? The trend right now is that we're having a hard time getting volunteers to be in our emergency medical, our first responders.
Well, I hope all our listeners are hearing that. We certainly need emergency medical responders. So if you have that ability, then give Keith a call.
Definitely. And I'll put you in touch with the department that serves your area.
Have you gotten any answers to those questions, what the demographics are, how they're shifting? And
the first thing we did is we looked through, again, from the beginning to the end of this system. So we reached out to our dispatch agencies, and next week or 2 weeks from now, I'm getting together with them. So we're going to go into all of those calls that came in and try and plot them out. Where do we get most of the calls for the ambulances from? What time of day is it? Is it morning? Is it afternoon? Is it evening? Because when you start talking about volunteers, for instance, McCallsburg, where do you think most of the people in McCallsburg work? Are they going to be available as volunteers during the middle of the day? So we look at all of those different things, and we're going to bring that together. We're going to work with our GIS person to map out where, again, these calls are coming from, the time frame that they're coming from, so that we can start that evaluation. Then we can start looking at the next step from that is, okay, if we see a trend in one area where we're going to need more ambulances, how are we going to make it so that we can do that most efficiently?
Okay. Well, Keith, that sounds like really interesting work. Thanks for sharing it with us.
No problem.
We began the show with citizen engagement, and we end with that idea as well. In the last few minutes, we air our first installment of Community Service Appreciation for the Month, a program in which Kay Puttock highlights the work of a different nonprofit each month. And January's nonprofit association is Friends of Emma Lee McCarthy Park and Munn Woods. If you know of a group you think deserves the spotlight, please let us know.
My guest for this month's Community Service Appreciation segment is Robin Schweitzer, who's the president of the nonprofit Friends of Emma Lee McCarthy Park and Munn Woods, which is rather long-winded. What do you like to call it?
Well, sometimes I just call it Lee Munn Friends, but the full and correct name is the Friends of Emma McCarthy Lee Park and Munn Woods.
Okay. And just briefly describe what this organization is, if you would, please.
Well, we're a local volunteer nonprofit organization focused on protecting and improving Emma McCarthy Lee Park and Munn Woods, especially focusing on the natural aspects thereof and nature-based recreation.
I'm sure a lot of people are very well aware of Emma Lee McCarthy Park and Munn Woods, but just telling people what it is and what it consists of, because it's not all nature. There's a playground, tennis courts, picnic areas and restrooms, two shelters.
Right.
So why don't you describe everything you've got out there?
Sure. Well, these are two city parks, about 40-some acres each, and the city recently purchased land to connect the two. So now they're connected, so you can walk all the way. And basically they run along Clear Creek, which is a very lovely creek, and both the woods and the park are down in a lovely little river valley.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real oasis of beautiful hardwood forest right within the city limits.
So that's the Munn Woods part.
Well, and Emma McCarthy Lee Park. The big difference between Lee Park and Munn Woods is that Munn Woods is pretty much all natural. There's no constructed facilities there.
Uh-huh.
There's no restrooms. There's no playgrounds. Whereas in Emma McCarthy Lee Park, it's a mixture of natural hardwood forests, open green space, athletic field, tennis courts, restroom, playgrounds. So it's a mix of built up recreational stuff and natural.
And is it just
natural.
A small sort of neck of land connecting them, or how does that work?
Yeah, essentially.
You were saying you're wanting to enhance particularly the natural aspects of this?
Yeah, one of my big focuses is invasive vegetation control. And in fact, that's how I first became involved in all this. Years and years ago, I worked for the Nature Conservancy and then the Olympic Natural Resources Center and doing invasive species control research. And when I moved back to Ames, I got permission from the City Parks and Rec Department to start cutting out some of the invasive vegetation in Emma McCarthy Lee Park. I started doing that about 4 years ago. And then we formed this organization last year.
It's a relatively new organization.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah, last year was our first full year. We have about, about 40 members.
Uh-huh.
And I'll make my plug right now. We're always looking for new members. We're looking for people, especially people who actually use the park and the woods, either the recreational facilities or people who go hiking in there. We have a pretty good representation already from adjacent landowners.
Mm-hmm.
So we got that contingent pretty well represented. But I'd like to get more people involved who actually go out there walking in the Munn Woods and Emma McCarthy Lee Park. So, one of our big focuses we use volunteers for is cutting out invasive Asian honeysuckle bushes and then buckthorn bushes, both immigrants that came to the U.S. about 100 years ago and started going wild. And they're a real threat to the
immigrant plants.
Yeah, immigrant. Invasive aliens. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, how do those get here?
They were both brought over as horticultural plants.
Right. Yeah, that's
and
one of the
another,
main.
There's another bad one, too, brought over at about the same time, also as a horticultural plant, a little herbaceous plant called garlic mustard, which we actually go out and pull and steam up and put a little butter on it and eat sometimes.
That's good, huh?
But it's good on your table, but it's bad in the woods. So those three plant species, the garlic mustard, the Asian honeysuckle, and the European buckthorn, are real threats to the ecology of the woods. So we use a lot of volunteers. We had well over 100 volunteers active during this year.
And they were mostly doing this, removing invasive species?
Exactly. Man, we'd get crews of like 25 people. We had a whole busload of 4-H youth come out because they were having their annual state conference here in Ames. And they had contacted Parks and Rec and said, oh, we'd like to do some kind of volunteer event. And Parks and Rec directed them to Emma McCarthy Lee Park, and I got involved. And, yeah, it's really great. We have a great relationship. I go out beforehand. I select an area that we're going to focus on. I go out with spray paint on a stick, and I go out and I mark the bases of the shrubs so that we know beforehand what we're going to be cutting out so we don't actually accidentally cut out anything that is a native plant. And then we get the volunteers to come in after that and cut them up and haul them out and throw them into a chipper.
You have to get them out by the roots. I mean, some of these must be pretty.
That's one good way to do it. But lots of times that's not very feasible. And actually, that tears up the ground a lot, too. So what we typically do is we go out, we cut it off as close to the ground as we can, and then we dab on a little topical herbicide right onto the freshly cut surface, and then that kind of gets down into the roots and kills the whole plant.
Without using a lot of spray.
Right. It's a whole lot better than just, spraying.
Well, I'm glad to hear that's what you do, because that's the sort of method I'd develop myself in my garden with invasive.
So that's just one of the things that we focus on. That was the first thing I started with, but now we're involved in doing some planning about trail maintenance and improvement, erosion control, improving the trail connection in Munn Woods. As I mentioned earlier, there's a beautiful little creek, Clear Creek, that flows through there. And Munn Woods is on both sides of Clear Creek. But when there's water in the creek, there's no good way to get across from one part into the other. Oh. So we're working with the Parks and Rec Department on getting some kind of a crossing planned and
a bridge
installed.
Or something?
Yeah, something real simple, low-tech.
Stepping stones
is a possibility. Perhaps some kind of real simple log bridge with a handrail or something like that. All kinds of stuff. Just picking up trash. Our group, we kind of are the eyes and the ears of the Parks and Rec Department because I'm down there almost every day walking my dog and hiking around. And people who actually are out there using it, they see things that need attention. And so then we can contact Parks and Rec Department and say, hey, this looks like, maybe this needs to be done. And everything that gets done by our group in the park and the woods is only by permission of the Parks and Rec Department because these are city parks. So We propose things and
then you have to get their agreement.
Then we have to get their agreement, but we've got a very nice relationship.
Have there been any controversies about use? Like you were talking about, like the shelters, the playground, the tennis courts. How other people wanted to say put in a, I don't know what, baseball field,
well,
football.
Funny you should mention that, because it was over a year ago now. It must have been about a year and a half ago. The city was planning on building a sand volleyball complex in this big flat green field in Lee Park. And a bunch of primarily it was people who live in the neighborhood mobilized to oppose that. And that was one of the seeds for our organization.
Oh.
But, you know, as I said before, you know, 3 years before that, I was out there cutting invasive vegetation and stuff.
Why exactly did they object to the volleyball?
Greatly increased traffic, vehicular traffic going down into the park and all along Ross Road. It would have been a real mess. It would have been a mess for parking. It would have been a mess. There's a narrow, steep vehicular access down into the park, and the volleyball complex would have been for organized competitive league.
League sports.
So you would have had up to 100 people coming and going every hour, many afternoons and evenings every day. And we just thought it was not really a good match for the neighborhood and the park. And we ultimately did prevail with that. They agreed to put that elsewhere, so we won that fight. But we're trying to be, you know, very agreeable and have a good harmonious relationship.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause,
like I said, nothing happens in the parks unless it, you know, passes with the Parks and Rec Department, which is as it should be.
Okay, let's put out your contact information. You can Google Lee Munn Friends. That's two N's, of course, in Munn, two E's in Lee. LeeMunnFriends.org.
Yep.
And I've been talking to Rob Schweitzer, whose phone number is 515-509-1094. Again, 515-509-1094. And that's LeeMunnFriends.org. Thank you very much, Rob Schweitzer.
Thank you, Kay.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. At the beginning of the show, we heard about the Issues Summit and Candidate Forum that will occur this Saturday, January 9th, in Des Moines, which KHOI will be broadcasting live and sharing with a national audience. Hugh Espy, director of the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, who is putting on the event, previewed it for us. Then I share my interview with David Redlosk, a political scientist who's already published one book about the caucuses, Why Iowa, and is planning another based on his treks around the state to take in candidate events. We were also joined by Keith Morgan, Emergency Management Coordinator for Story County, and heard Kay Puttock's interview with Rob Schweitzer, representing the Friends of Emily McCarthy Park and Munn Woods, as part of our Community Service Appreciation Program for the month of January. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Nadia Abdelazim. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Ghosts by the sister group IBEI. That's IBEI. YI from their self-titled album of 2015. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.